a strong monarchy working together with Parliament as the crown in Parliament. He succeeded in bringing peace to the country and rehabilitating it economically. And also in part at least further learning the introduction of the Renaissance of humanism and humanism into England. When he died, he had succeeded in making an alliance with Ferdinand and Isabella of Spain. However, he was not succeeded by his first son. His first son had died shortly before, but he was succeeded by his second son, Arthur, who then married his brother's widow. This was in 1509. Now, Henry VIII also was a strong king. It was he who separated England from the papal church. Henry VIII was much more of a spendthrift than was his father, much more of a playboy. Henry VII would have shuddered at the thought that anybody supposed that he would have played around. But Henry VIII also was a furtherer of the Renaissance and of learning. He furthered the work of Erasmus and of Sir Thomas More and of John Collett, the Oxford reformers. But Henry VIII was living in even a more revolutionary day than was his father, because early in his reign, the monk of Wittenberg caused some disturbances in Germany, and these were reflected in England. In England, at the beginning of the reign of Henry VIII, you still have the persistence of Lollardy, the followers of John Wycliffe, who had died in 1384. There is a great deal of anti-clericalism in England. One wit remarked to the Spanish ambassador that the price of wood had gone up in London because so many Lollards were being burnt. Lutheranism, in the writings of Luther, were introduced into England already in 1517. In 1517, Erasmus sent 95 propositions that Luther had composed to his friend John Cobbett. By the time we come down to the year 1520, we know that booksellers were selling Luther's works. I have, for instance, worked through the day book of a bookseller by the name of John Donne in Oxford. And he records day by day what books he sells. And there, every now and then, there is a work of Luther's that shows up. And he even sold the first edition of Luther's complete works in 1520. They weren't quite complete by that time, but what was complete by that day. On the 12th of May, in the year 1521, in the courtyard of St. Paul's Church in London, the books of Martin Luther were burnt. Wolsey presided over the festivities. John Fisher preached the sermon. Henry VIII wasn't there. Henry VIII was sick on that day. The event is important not merely because it documents for us that Luther's books were taken seriously in England, but you will remember that on the 18th of April in 1521, this man, Martin Luther, gave a little speech in the town of Worms, where the members of the Diet of the Holy Roman Empire were assembled. Even before Luther appeared before the Diet of Worms, a few days before that, the ambassador of Henry VIII had hurried away from Worms, had come back to London, and immediately the machinery got into motion, and the books of Luther were burnt in on the 12th of May. This was a signal to Europe that Henry VIII, and particularly Cardinal Wolsey, were on the side of Leo X and Charles V, the Emperor of the Holy Roman Empire. Events of this sort simply don't happen in a vacuum. And the events in the church don't happen in a vacuum. Political, social, economic events and forces are important in the history of the church. And even a relatively minor event like the burning of Luther's books has meaning in a wider context. At this time, if you want to read more about it, you can find my article in the Journal of the Ecclesiastical History for October 1958 on this particular event. At this time, Henry VIII was writing, or was getting help in writing, a book which he called the Assertio Septem Sacramentorum, the defense of the seven sacraments. The book was presented to Leo X, and in time, Henry VIII was given the title of Defensor Fidei, the Defender of the Faith. The English monarch still proudly bears this title. She defends a different faith, however. About this time in Cambridge, you have a group of scholars getting together off campus in the White Horse Tavern. They were known, this was a respectable place. They were known as the Germans. And they were already reading and studying Martin Luther's books. There were probably some 50 of them. I'm not going to mention more than about 5 of them. One of them was Thomas Bilney, B-I-L-N-E-Y. Thomas Bilney was burnt at the stake in 1531, a martyr because of his faith. I'm not saying that he was a Lutheran. I don't think that he was. But he wasn't satisfied with the Roman Catholic Church, and he wasn't satisfied with what Henry VIII was doing to promote religion. Another one was Robert Barnes, B-A-R-N-E-S. He was burnt at the stake on the 30th of July in 1540. Luther called him Saint Robert. Robert Barnes spent some time in Luther's house. Henry VIII used him as a diplomatic agent for a time. Among all the theologians of England in the first half of the 16th century, Robert Barnes is the only one who can be classified as a genuine Lutheran. Our brethren in England today still have the Barnes Conference to signalize their ties with the past and to honor this man, Robert Barnes, the Lutheran in England. Professor Neelak Chernagel of our Concordia Teachers College in River Forest has just published the Reformation Essays of Robert Barnes. They're good Lutheran reading on Holy Scriptures, on free will, the office of the keys, the church justification, and so on. And nice paperback little job that Lutheran clergymen can afford to read. A third member of this White Horse Tavern group was Hugh Latimer, L-A-T-I-M-E-R. Hugh Latimer died at the stake in 1555. It was he who said to Ridley, when the two of them were about to be burnt, "Be a man, for this day we shall light a candle which shall never be put out in England." Hugh Latimer is one of the great pulpit orators of English religious history. One of the most famous preachers of all time. He was Protestant. I'm not saying he was Lutheran, but he was Protestant and died under Mary because of his Protestant beliefs. Another member of this group was Miles Coverdale. And you know Miles Coverdale for his translation, at least a portion of the Old Testament, for promoting the scriptures. Miles Coverdale died a natural death in 1564. And then one man who probably was not a member of this Cambridge group, but who was at Cambridge at the time, is Thomas Cranmer, who was burnt at the stake in 1556. 1556 for Thomas Cranmer. Cranmer was enough of a scholar and interested enough in current theological writings that even during this time, I feel relatively certain he read some of Luther's works. When he went to England in 1530, he went to Osiander in Nuremberg and spent some time in the house of the Lutheran preacher there, Osiander. And while there, managed to marry Osiander's niece. This doesn't make him a Lutheran. Then we have the so-called Hanse merchants, the merchants of the Hanseatic League in London, in the Steelyard, who we know were selling Luther's books. And last of all, we have to recall that William Tyndale, and he left England probably in 1523, went overseas and went to Wittenberg. This is pretty well established. You have the Tyndale Arch here on campus. That does not make Tyndale a Lutheran. You have the fact that Tyndale used Luther's introductions and some of Luther's notes, and certainly Luther's text for his translation of the New Testament. And this does not make William Tyndale a Lutheran, but it does mean that he was dependent upon Martin Luther. Tyndale differed with Luther on the doctrine of the Lord's Supper. He followed the views of the Swiss reformers on the doctrine of the Lord's Supper. But Tyndale, who incidentally also was burnt at the stake, and this in 1536, in the Netherlands, not in England, in 1536, deserves to be remembered, underscore his name, for for his translation of the New Testament. 1525. So you have the Novum Instrumentum of Erasmus in 1516. You have the translation of Tyndale in 1525 of the New Testament. Lutheranism then with Lollardy was an important factor leading to the Reformation in England. And then we also have to reckon with dynastic and personal problems, particularly of Henry VIII. By the time Henry VIII had been married for 10 years, he was very much disappointed in his consort, Catherine of Aragon, because she had borne no male child that lived. Now remember that the Tudor dynasty is a new dynasty. Henry is only the second one in the dynasty. He's anxious to perpetuate this dynasty. And England had known only one female ruler up to this time, Empress Maud, and she was regarded as a usurper. Henry didn't feel that he could take a chance on a female succession. Then someone at least reminded him of the passage in Leviticus 18 which says that if a man marries his brother's widow, that marriage shall be childless. Shakespeare has it in his play Henry VIII. One character says that Henry doth creep too near his conscience. And the other character says, methinks his conscience creeps too near another woman. And Henry VIII had extramarital affairs, no one will deny. He did not contract syphilis from sitting on a toilet seat. But he became enamored of a woman who had served, had been at the French court, Anne Boleyn. It's B-O-L-E-Y-N, Anne Boleyn. Anne had a great desire to be queen. And whether Henry said to Anne, we ought to get married or something, and Anne said to him, we ought to get married or nothing, or just what happened. At any rate, Anne held out. And Henry finally decided to make her his queen. But in order to do this, and the machinery had gotten started much before this, the king's great matter was agitated at court and in the courts of Europe. Catherine simply refused to consent to an annulment. And Henry appealed to Rome. I'm not going to go into all the ramifications of the diplomatic dealings here. Clement VII was Pope at Rome at this time. He was vacillating. He didn't dare to offend Charles V. Finally, he decided to send an emissary, Campeggio, to London. A trial was held. Henry VIII was cited. Catherine was cited. And then one day in July, Campeggio adjourned court without rendering a decision because he said that at this time all the courts in Rome adjourned. It was simply that he was not ready to offend, or Clement VII was not ready to offend Charles V. About this time, someone told Henry VIII that he had a brilliant scholar at the University of Cambridge who had made the suggestion that the king's great matter ought to be referred to the universities. And Henry said that man has the sow by the right ear, or he said that he has the right sow by the ear. At any rate, Henry called Cranmer to him, and the machinery got into motion to refer the question to the various universities of Europe. Now, if you know university faculties, you will know that these universities did not agree. But in 1532, then, the archbishop died, Archbishop Warham, Archbishop of Canterbury, died. Henry VIII nominated Thomas Cranmer as archbishop. Clement VII granted the request of Henry VIII, and Cranmer was inducted then as Archbishop of Canterbury. This is early in 1533. Immediately he cited Henry VIII before the Archbishop's court because he was, or had any intercourse with Catherine of Aragon. And then in May granted the divorce. Henry had been married to Anne Boleyn in January of 1533, and on September the 7th in 1533, Elizabeth was born. Henry had two female heirs, Mary, the daughter of Catherine of Aragon, and Elizabeth, the daughter of Anne Boleyn. Now, of course, taking matters into his own hands meant that Henry VIII was excommunicated by the... That's a poor sentence. But at any rate, Henry VIII was excommunicated. He put the parliamentary machinery into motion in order to legally separate the English church from Rome. We can't go into the details of the legislation. In 1532, you have a submission of the clergy. They agreed that Henry VIII was the supreme head of the church in England, insofar as the law of Christ allows. The same year, in 1532, there was the conditional restraint of annates. The first fruits of the bishoprics were withheld. Henry was using economic sanctions. In the following year, you have the restraints of appeal, restraint of appeals. No appeals were allowed to go to Rome, and this, of course, meant that no one could appeal the decision of Cranmer in the divorce, or the annulment case, to be more exact. Then in 1534, you have an act forbidding papal dispensations and payment of Peter's pence. The act forbidding papal dispensations in payment of Peter's pence. It almost sounds like Peter picked. Again, economic sanctions. And then in 1534, and this is why the date is on the board, 1534, you have the Acts of Succession. And the Act of Supremacy. The Act of Supremacy, which made Henry VIII the supreme head, caput is a word that is used, the supreme head of the church in England. This is the breaking of the bonds with Rome. By this time, Wolsey had been discarded. Wolsey was discarded as Chancellor in 1529. Sir Thomas More refused to swear to the Act of Supremacy, and then he was beheaded in 35. Thomas Cromwell, this is Thomas Cromwell, was appointed the chief minister of Henry. Thomas Cromwell was executed in 1540. Please don't confuse Thomas Cromwell, who died in 1540, with Oliver Cromwell, who died in 1658. But Thomas Cromwell was the big engineer of the change, ecclesiastical change in England. Of particular importance is the dissolution of the monasteries in 1536. These are the small monasteries. The larger ones came a bit later. But this provided Henry VIII with some revenue. And of course, this established some important centers for religion in England. In the same year, in 1536, you have the uprising in the northern part of England known as the Pilgrimage of Grace. The Pilgrimage of Grace, the uprising in the northern part of England. Due partly to the religious changes, due partly to economic and social causes. But by 1536, Henry VIII had tired of Anne Boleyn. The formal charges were fornication and incest. And why the charges had to be made so strong, I don't know. I can't find any evidence in the records myself that Anne Boleyn was anything but a faithful wife to Henry VIII. Probably because she had a miscarriage or had two miscarriages and had no male child. Probably because Jane Seymour had caught the fancy of Henry VIII. At any rate, Anne Boleyn was beheaded. She has a beautiful confession of faith written on the day before her execution. Jane Seymour gave Henry a third heir, Edward VI. Of course, he was called Edward, not the sixth, when he was baptized. But the Act of Succession had to be changed again, and in the Act of Succession, Henry provided that Edward and then Mary and then Elizabeth should succeed him. In the last part of the 1530s, after Henry had broken with Rome, he was looking for friends. He couldn't find a friend in Charles V. He couldn't find one in Francis I. So he had to turn to Protestant princes. And there is a series of negotiations with the German Protestant princes. Philip of Hesse, John of Saxony, and so on. They wanted Henry VIII to sign the Augsburg Confession. Henry VIII wasn't quite ready to do it. But he sent diplomats over to Wittenberg in 1536, and they drew up the Ten Articles. The Germans sent diplomats to London, and they drew up the 13 Articles. Henry VIII even married a German Protestant princess. She wasn't Lutheran. But eventually, Henry changed his political orientation, and the negotiations with the Protestant princes became null. Cromwell, it seems, was very much in favor of the Lutheran alliance. And there are indications that his personal beliefs tended toward Lutheranism. Robert Barnes, who was a negotiator, was very strongly in favor of the alliance and promoted Lutheran doctrine. But both Robert Barnes and Thomas Cromwell were beheaded in the same year. However, in these years you have the circulation of scriptures. John Rogers, Miles Coverdale, Thomas Cranmer all helped in promoting the circulation of scriptures. In spite of the six articles which Parliament passed in 1539. Just a word about Thomas Cranmer. Thomas Cranmer left, I believe, a fourfold legacy to the English Church. You have his so-called catechism, which he did not write nor translate, but it's known as Cranmer's Catechism. You have the so-called Cranmer's Bible, which he did not translate, but for which he prepared a preface. It follows the Great Bible of 1539. You have the Books of Common Prayer, the first and second Book of Common Prayer, and then the 42 Articles. Writings of Cranmer, some of the writings of Cranmer I've selected. Cranmer's selected writings published by the SBCK in London will give you an acquaintance with this man. I think he's worthwhile knowing also as a theologian. When Henry VIII son died, in 1547, Edward VI, the boy king, the Josiah for the Protestants, came to the throne, and Cranmer was the chief advisor. Edward VI reigned from 1547 to 1553. His reign can be divided into two periods, the period under the Duke of Somerset, in the period under the Duke of Warwick. Ecclesiastically, the first period was the conservative. I'm willing to call it the more Lutheran period. The second period, about halfway between, was the more radical, the Calvinistic period. It's in the second period that you have the foreign divines coming to England. Fuchs, of Strasbourg, John Alasco, and others, men who bring with them the ideas from Geneva and Zurich. In this period, you have the composition of the first Edwardian prayer book in 1649. In its teaching on the Eucharist, it is Luther. And the source is a Lutheran source, taken from the formularies adopted in Cologne. The second Edwardian book of 1552 is, I think, Calvinistic. It's equivocal. It teaches both the real presence and the memorial doctrine of the Lord's Supper. The first prayer book has been called the best composition that has come out, liturgical composition that has come out of the period of the Reformation. Besides the books of common prayer, you have the Book of Homilies. This was the Blue Bible for the clergy of England. There were 12 homilies which they were told to read in their pulpits unless they had the license to preach. And relatively few of them got the license to preach, and so they read these homilies. They didn't even have to apologize for them. The Book of Homilies becomes extremely important, however, in teaching the doctrinal climate in England. The period of Edward VI, we ought to have more time or to spend more time on it, consolidates Protestantism in England. In the period, as indicated, you have a shift from an emphasis on Lutheran doctrine to an emphasis on Calvinistic doctrine. But the 42 articles revamped by Parker in 1562 retained largely their Lutheran characteristic, with the exception of the articles on the sacraments, on baptism and the Lord's Supper. Article 17 on predestination is not Calvinistic. It's biblical. It's Lutheran. The reign of Edward VI was followed by the reign of Mary. Sometimes she's referred to as Bloody Mary because of the execution under her reign, in her reign. Now, Mary, the daughter of Catherine of Aragon, could not but restore Roman Catholicism to England. Her chief advisor was Cardinal Reginald Pole, P-O-L-E. Both of them died on the same day, on the 17th of November in 1658. Pole was a humanist. He was one of the liberal cardinals in the first sessions of the Council of Trent. He persuaded Mary to make a compromise and not to require the return of the church land that the nobles had received, but simply to be satisfied with the apology Now, finally, England was restored to the Church of Rome and received absolution then from the hands of Reginald Pole. Mary married Philip II of Spain, the heir of Charles V, and the Spanish immediately became very unpopular in England. When Mary became queen, many of the Protestants, about 800 of the Protestants, fled to the continent. They settled down in Frankfurt, in Geneva, a few in Zurich. Of those that stayed at home, some were burnt at the stake. We have the record in Fox's Book of Martyrs, or the Action Monument. John Fox, F.O.S.E., gathered the literary record of the martyrs under Mary, and in a period of 45 months, about 300 were burnt at the stake because of their Protestant beliefs. The most important we've mentioned already. Thomas Cranmer, Roger, the first of the martyrs, Hugh Latimer, Ridley, but most of these people were from the common people, the little people, who remained true to their Protestantism. There were others, some of the big people that equivocated and saved their necks. When Mary died on the 17th of November in 1558, there were very few people in England that were sorry about it. There was dancing in the streets of London that night. And Elizabeth became queen. Elizabeth reigned from 1658 to 1603 and has given her name to an era. She was pretty sure of herself. She had good advisors. Her chief advisor was William Cecil, C-E-C-I-L. She, through Parliament, brought back Protestantism to England. Looking at Europe, Elizabeth could expect some animosity from Spain, some from France. In France, you have the Huguenot War. She intervened in the Netherlands in order to help the Protestants there. But mainly, Elizabeth relied on England as an island bastion and relied on the nationalism, the patriotism, and the personal loyalty of her people. She stabilized the economy. Inflation had taken some great strides in England during the reign of Edward VI and Mary, and this is one reason the reign of Mary was unpopular. But with the restoration of the currency in 1563, Elizabeth succeeded in restoring some of the prosperity to her country. She furthered trade with the Netherlands. She furthered education, it's during her reign that you have the period of Marlowe and Spencer and Shakespeare. William Shakespeare, born in 1564. It's a happy 400th anniversary, Bill. Shakespeare died in 1616. But all of these factors help to advance and to glorify, if I can use that term, the reign of good Queen Beth. In church history, one of the most noteworthy events is in 1559. On the 8th of May, in 1559, Elizabeth signed the Act of Supremacy and the Act of Uniformity. The Act of Supremacy made her the supreme governor of the church in England. Her father had been supreme head. She was modest about it, and she became supreme governor. The Act of Uniformity restored the Book of Common Prayer, the Elizabethan prayer book, as a compromise between the first and the second prayer, the prayer book of the Edwardian period. It provides for both formulas for the distribution of the Lord's Supper together. Matthew Parker, as Archbishop of Canterbury, reworked the 39 articles and came up, the 42 articles, and came up with the 39 articles. The 39 articles, which became the Confession of Faith then of the Anglican Church. The episcopacy was restored, or was retained better. The episcopacy was retained in England. In the first part of her reign, Elizabeth was kindly disposed toward the old religion. She did not persecute the Roman Catholics. When, however, in 1570, she was excommunicated and her subjects were absolved from loyalty to her, she retaliated in part. And gradually we can see a tightening up of restrictions on the Roman Catholics, as there was a tightening up then too later on of restrictions on the Puritans. But with the Elizabethan settlement of 1569, you have uniformity, or at least a trend of toward religious uniformity in England. And Anglicanism, of course, was disrupted during the period of the Civil War in the middle of the 17th century. Restored again under Charles II in 1661. And is today yet the state religion in England, so that the Elizabethan settlement is of consequence to the present day. That strict adherence to the 39 articles is required in the English Church, no one will say, but England at any rate had what we know as Anglicanism, inherited from the reign of Elizabeth VI. There is one other factor in the religious history of 16th century England that we have to look at, and that is the rise of Puritanism. Puritanism has its rise in the Middle Ages. We can blame Wycliffe and the Lollards in part on it. The Christian Brethren helped to perpetuate it. the Cambridge group and the Marian exiles fed Puritanism, Bullinger of Zurich and John Calvin of Geneva, Martin Luther, who came to England from Strasbourg, John Knox, the Presbyterian of Scotland, John Hooper, all had their contributions to make toward Puritanism, at least toward the beginning of Puritanism. Puritanism shows itself, first of all, in the so-called Bestialian controversy in Cambridge. The Bestialian controversy was, as the name indicates, the controversy regarding vestments. This is what they started with. And from liturgical matters went on into church polity, the question of the government of bishops, went over to the interpretation of scriptures, and you have a variety of Puritans, independent Puritans who wanted to have separate, but have independent churches within the Church of England. You have separatistic Puritans who wanted to separate from the Church of England. You have congregational Puritans who wanted to have a congregational polity in the churches. You have Presbyterian Puritanism, those who wanted the Presbyterian form of government in the churches. And you have also among the Puritans mystics. It's extremely difficult to generalize much about the Puritans, but they did adopt in time the covenant theology, of William Ames and William Perkins, the great covenant theologian of England. Puritanism was transferred into this country in the 17th century. Puritanism dominated the American scene pretty well during the 19th century, and it is only in our own generation that we have come to what people call the post-Protestant era in American Christianity, which would better be called the post-Puritan era. This is actually what it is. So the English Reformation, in its hatred of Roman Catholicism, which goes back to the period of the Marian persecution, in its Anglicanism, in its high regard for Anglicanism, and in its Puritan emphasis, particularly the covenant theology, is of great consequence for the religious scene in this country. That will quit as a rapid overview of this century. There are many details that might be added, but this gives you the very broad sketch of this particular, of the particular developments during the Tudor period. When Elizabeth died in 1603, James I of Scotland became King of England, and his reign and the reign of his son Charles I then led to the civil wars of the 1640s, and the period of Oliver Cromwell, and then the restoration of Andersonism in 1661. With the coming of toleration, then in 1689, you have religious toleration across in England, and this too, this can be regarded as one of the great heritages for this country for the 17th century. That's 1588. You ought to know that without asking. What's going to be the answer? The defeat of the Spanish Armada. The defeat of the Spanish Armada, which gave the New World, or at least in North America, made North America open to the English. Any other questions in a half an hour, half a minute? Great.